Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, welcome to The Hobcast. It's show 11, and a little later, our big special guest is Lewis Hastings, who joins us from the other side of the world. And we'll talk about his amazing career in law enforcement. That's about as much as we can say about it. And his incredible story as a writer of the seventh trilogy, The Angel of Whitehall, and the forthcoming Chemist. More details about that to come in a two-part interview. So this week and next week, Lewis Hastings is our guest. But who are we? I'm Adrian Hobart.
I'm Rebecca Collins.
Together, we are Hoback Books, and this is The Hobcast, where we discuss what it's like running a small UK independent publisher of the following genres: crime,
suspense,
mystery,
thrillers.
I think thrillers is a bit more macho than that, don't you think?
Shouldn't it be thrilling, though? Thrillers are thrilling.
Yeah, well, if they're written well, yeah. Anyway, thrillers. That's a bit more like it, a bit more Culverhouse. Well, welcome to the program. And as we say, it's show 11 and it grows and grows each week. And well, as we start the news, sadly, later we're going to be paying tribute to two members of the Hoback family who passed on this week. More details of that a little later. But there's been some very positive news as well within the Hoback family. We've made it to number one.
Yay! Number one.
Yeah, our first book to reach number one in a category on Amazon, Daria's Daughter, reaching number one in Canada in psychological thrillers this week, which is a really big category. And in fact, it was last night as we speak. So we were dancing around the kitchen.
And we were celebrating with a can of Diet Coke.
We only had the one left between us, so it had to stretch. And we didn't have anything to put in it. But nonetheless, it was worth a celebration. So congratulations to Linda Huber. Fantastic author, based over in Switzerland. We spoke to her in, I think it was show 7, something like that. Anyway, go back through our back episodes at our podcast site and also on our website, www.hobeck.net, and also at your platform where you can find all the previous episodes of The Hobcast. So we got a number one. That's just fantastic. So it's a milestone for us. Certainly one of our aims for this year was to achieve that and to get that bestseller tag that you get from Amazon, which is a tremendous honour.
It is indeed. Yes, the little orange thing that you see on the screen.
It means a lot to us publishing folk. So that is a reason to celebrate. Now, in the news this week, something not really to celebrate and something to feel quite sad about. One of our fellow independent publishers, Urbane Books, who used to publish one of our authors, Robert Dawes, his original publisher, sadly announced this week that they were ceasing trading. And they were pioneers, really, in what we're doing, independent publishing from the UK. Really very sad. And they cited two reasons, didn't they?
They did. And, I mean, it's fairly expected, actually. One of them, of course, was the effects of the pandemic, which, although you sort of hear mixed results from various publishers, different sizes of publishers, on the effect of the pandemic on their business, but it really has affected the smaller independent publishers, especially those sort of the more well-established ones, I think. Mm. And the other reason they cited was good old Brexit.
Yeah. So for the reasons that we've been talking about in recent weeks, it's simply too expensive to export back into the EU now with something with such low margins as books. So that's certainly one of the reasons that Urbane said that they were leaving us. But yeah, the bookshop side of things, they had penetrated the fourth wall, if you like, getting into bookshops. But the downside is, with bookshops in the UK having been shut for the last nearly four months and previous periods during lockdowns, you know, those sales have dried up. And it's an expensive business anyway, getting into bookshops. The margins are small, and it's really about the cachet. Unless you're shifting tens of thousands of units, it's hard to make money on it. And when that supply dries up, then that's the impact. So terribly sorry for the team at Urbane, also for all the authors that they signed up and pioneered across many genres, not least the ones that we deal with. And it's always sad to see part of our ecosystem going. I mean, you know, you could take the mercantile and business route and saying that's one less rival, but that's not how we feel about it, because it is an independent publishing community. And when I tweeted about it this week, Urbane came back to me and said, keep fighting the good fight, which was really sweet of them in their hour of need, really, that they would respond in such a way and recognize that we're trying to sort of carry on. But it does show, I think, that there's a lot of misinformation going around, I think, in the publishing industry. A lot of people saying, oh, it's been brilliant, having a lockdown has actually, you know, boosted our profits and all this sort of thing. And I think that that's true if you are a company who hasn't previously distributed aggressively digitally. Yeah, there was a market to go and find there. But if you were relying in a 50-50 hybrid way on ebooks and physical copies, then it's not been so good. And I think that it's an important warning.
Yeah, I mean, it's our situation is quite interesting, because we started just 2 months before the pandemic hit. So we actually don't know any different from operating under a pandemic situation. So, but yeah, I think what you said is actually very valid, that if you are relying 50-50 on sort of more traditional outlets and more modern ones, then yes, of course, half of your business is going to struggle.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's another factor here, is that that's one less publisher for people to submit manuscripts to. And, you know, we've had our submission gate open and closed over the last few months. We've opened it again. But just to make clear, if you're listening to us and want to submit to Hoback Books, we are looking at manuscripts, but it's taking us a very long time. There's just the two of us. We have to judge independently who we wish to publish and who we don't. And we also offer advice when we write back to you and say, you know, why perhaps we haven't picked you up, or, you know, there may be a case, as there often is, somebody who is almost there. And we just say, look, if you tweak these things and look at these aspects of your work, then we'll speak again. But it takes time, and the rest of the business takes time too. So we are open again, but with that caveat that it might take us quite some time to get round to looking at your manuscript. But yeah, it's important that, you know, we have new talent coming in, and it's important for people out there to have somewhere to go to. And, you know, many, many publishers simply have the wall up at the moment.
Yes, that's true. I think I've spoken about this before, but one of my other jobs is editor on the Writers and Artists Yearbook. And I've noticed, as I've had updates to the entries for the publishers this year, that so many more are closed to submissions at the moment.
They are. Look, another success story, if we can sort of bounce between our success, the Urbane story, and also another success story, and I'm sure it's purely coincidental, but I'm shameless, I'm going to take credit for it. Matt Brolly, who was a guest on this show a couple of weeks ago, has had an amazing experience, which is going to number one with a book that he released back in July, The Crossing, part of that series that he was talking about, set in the West Country, and it went to number one, nearly a year after its first release, which is a fantastic achievement. So congratulations, Matt. But how much of the credit of that you appeared on our podcast the same week? maybe I'm stretching it.
I know we'd like to think that, but...
Well, it all helps is what the way we always look at it.
Yeah, so that one extra person who listened to our podcast and went out and bought the book tipped the balance.
Yeah, just that one extra copy. That's that gets you to number one. No, it's a fantastic achievement. And it just goes to show, you know... As Matt was saying, you know, he's been patient. He'd written four or five other novels, in fact, six or seven, actually, if you think about the other genres that he was doing standalones in, before becoming an overnight success, and a massive success he is now, too. So congratulations to him and a good friend to the show. So let's get on with the interview. Have we covered everything we wanted to talk about? I think we have.
I think we probably have. I think it's about time we talk to somebody else.
Okay, well, we'll talk about our week and a few other items a little bit later, plus also our own crime scandal that is rocking Hoback. But that's after we speak. Yeah, okay, all right, okay, all right. I've upset you now. Let's talk to Lewis Hastings. Now, we'll talk about this in the interview, but Lewis came to us on a Twitter tweet to you in Tesco's car park. That's how we came into contact. And lo and behold, a few months down the line, we were publishing all four of his completed novels. The seventh series featuring Jack Cade and a standalone Jack Cade novel, The Angel of Whitehall. They all came out in December. They've done very well for us and for him. And he has a fascinating story to tell. But let's let him explain what he does for a living.
My day job. Yes, my day job is, I suppose you have to go back to the roots, which is 1990, the dim and distant past, when I, having drifted from job to job, sales through to working for a big broadsheet newspaper, the Nottingham Evening Post, glorious newspaper of its day. And I was working during the UK miners' strike. And that's when the seed was sown to join the police, which is actually a family tradition going back to about 1820. I don't mean, you know, nearly half past six. I mean, back in the Victorian times. And I joined the police in 90 with a band of brothers and sisters, and would have done 30 years in the UK up until the point where I was offered the opportunity to travel across the other side of the world with my family and try same job, different country. So that's where I am. And now, for the last 17 years, I've been specializing in what I guess you could call border policing. So my role is very much an international level, looking at threats to this country, right across the Pacific, networking through the US, right across to the dear old United Kingdom, and with an incredible array of people and processes that keep the world safe, and particularly over the last year, of course. So I can tell you about the things I've done in the last 18 months, and it would blow your mind, because we've had some significant tests here, as I'm sure you've seen in the media. So that's a summary, and I guess it gives me those the day job that gives me my night job stories to tell.
Indeed. And so one of the things that attracted us when we'll talk about how we all got together, and it's one of Rebecca's favorite stories, so I'll allow her to share that, but it is the fact that your books are rooted in experience, that you've done some of this stuff and you know people who have lived the life of Jack Cade. We're talking about the Jack Cade books, four of which are now with us, and we'll soon get The Chemist, which is number five, we hope. So when people read your books, they are getting, I guess, you know, it's from the horse's mouth, really.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. And you know, look, there's this over cliched write what you know, but I can't write about pottery or ballet, because I'm hopeless at both. Probably better at ballet than I am at pottery, actually, looking back. But
now there's an image.
But the reality is, if you write what you know, then for me the acid test is, will someone be sitting in a room somewhere reading one of my books and say, you can't do it that way? And I hope they never do. I hope they realize that either my research or my researchers, because I'm lucky to have a really amazing team around the globe that support me at a minute's notice, or my own experience. So if you talk about something as simple as loading a Glock pistol, racking it and firing it, if you've never done it and you try to write about it, it won't be authentic. So yeah, you're right. Write what you know, for me, is absolutely critical. And I won't write about things within the law enforcement world that I don't understand, because yeah, the likes of people like Graham Bartlett will be on my back very quickly and telling me that that's not how you do it.
Yeah, are you ever tempted to go down that route as Graham has? I mean, Graham Bartlett, for those who don't know, is the I suppose the brains and the brains trust behind, you know, Peter James's books and some of ours as well have gone through his hands, essentially as an experienced British policeman. He is casting his eye over people's books and checking them for veracity and believability. and doing a very good job of it. Does that ever tempt you?
It does and it doesn't. I mean, you know, if I had, excuse me, if I had the time, I'd probably write another 5 books a year. But the reality is that I'm already in the background assisting some writers. I'm involved in a couple of syndicates that do offer, I guess, a service to writers, where you can go one-to-one and they can come to Bang to Write is something that I've spoken to about yesterday. And you know, sites like that are tremendous for modern authors who want to write about crime or policing or police procedures, but have never actually put into that world. I do often get emails from people asking me for advice, and I give it willingly, Adrian, because I don't charge for it. I just don't think it's appropriate to. My career has been very good to me, and if I can allow that information to feed down into writers, we've all been there, haven't we? We've all been at the very beginning of our writing career. And I think that's, I guess it's karma, isn't it? Literary karma.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's very, very important to give back and to give freely and to, you know, be approachable.
Well, that's right. I mean, you talk about the great Peter James there. I mean, I think you know the story that it was probably, excuse me, about 4 years ago, Peter was in Jamaica. And I wrote to, sounds like the beginning of a joke, doesn't it? But I wrote to him and I said, look, Peter, you base your stories in Brighton. And my name is Lewis Hastings, which, as you know, if you know the Sussex geography, those are 3 towns that run alongside each other down the coast. It appealed to him enough to write back. And he was one of those people that really, I guess, put me very much on the conveyor belt because he bothered to write back. And that's why I write back to people. It might only take 5 or 10 minutes, but what a great thing to receive from one of the world's best crime writers, a personal letter, whilst he was actually doing some research in Jamaica for one of his thrillers. And he said 2 things which I'll always remember. Number one, just keep writing. I think he was 59 when he started, so I'm well within that. And the other was, when you get your first 1-star review, welcome to the elite club of authors. You've made it.
That's a good piece of advice. A lot of us could, because it's difficult. I mean, you get the 1 stars, and I know it's part of our job to pick people up off the floor when they get one. It's very hard to know, but you know, that's the nature of the world at the moment, where people have an opportunity. They love the power that a 1-star review, the thrill. I rarely think a 1-star review is genuine. Honestly, I genuinely believe it's someone just exercising their power of, making their mark on the world by doing somebody down.
Yeah, because it's not that long ago when people couldn't assert their power in that way, readers. You know, they would have to actually write a physical letter to the author, and not many people bothered to do that. But now they just type on their keyboard and boom, it's there for you to see. So... I mean, how do you deal with when you get a review like that?
Well, the first thing I did was track them down and deployed Jack Cade and the team to their home address. And there's probably fresh soil in a forest somewhere, but he says tongue in cheek in case the law.
Everybody go try this at home.
I'd like to think you're joking, but I sense them. No.
Well, we've heard many more drones flying overhead since we signed you up.
Yeah, that's true.
That's right, and the soil is still fresh on the spade. No, I mean, the reality is, look, I took it terribly in the first 3 days, and it was only when Mrs. Hastings said, you know what, I'm actually glad that you've got a 1-star review, because anybody that's looking to buy your books and sees only 5 stars, they're going to be suspicious. So to that reviewer, I actually replied to them on Amazon, and since Amazon have taken away the right of the author to respond, which I think is a dreadful shame, because I think any review is positive, really, honestly, because it's certainly, it allowed me time to have a look at myself, to make me realize that just like books, people are subjective and not everybody's going to like what I write. Simple, plain fact. If the majority do, and let's be honest, if one person reads a story that I've written and enjoys it and feels the need to write to me or to publish a review that says, I enjoyed this because, then it's a success.
And I must admit, that's one thing that I do admire about you. I notice that when somebody puts a positive review on Amazon, you tweet about it. You know, you say, look, this has brightened my day. This is lovely. Thank you so much, so-and-so. I'm glad you enjoyed the book. So I guess my question to you now is sort of related to that, because you are very active on social media and you're obviously very busy in your day job. How on earth do you find time to write?
Yeah, that's actually a very common question, because I'm on Goodreads as well, which was a gold mine. I found some wonderful reviews on there. I think the reality is, I think there was a character in one of the Bond films, it might have been Die Another Day, who never slept. And I think I'm in that elite, I suppose, core of authors that, you know, you just, this is an obsession. This is it's almost bordering on an illness, I think, but an illness that's actually wonderful, because it does you good at the same time. I know that sounds contradictory, but so for me, I have very busy day job, very busy away from work, and I have to try to structure in some time to write. I get very little time to read, which does bother me. But the social media, I have to blame the real Carrie O'Shea for that, because she was going on at me about Twitter for 2 years, where I was just existing on Facebook. And within a year, the exposure had, well, it was 1,000-fold and climbing. And whilst I was never going to sort of tap on the doors of Katy Perry, there was a feeling that this expansion was quite dramatic. And I've got nearly 4,000 followers on Twitter, for example, and I've written to every single one. Now, I'm either strange, mad, or stupid, or it shows that I actually do genuinely appreciate getting feedback from people, because let's face it, it's social media is the death knell or the lifeline for any modern author or publisher or TV star. You know, you're at the behest of the keyboard, aren't you?
You are. You are, and it is, as you say, I mean, it's the forum which we all have to deal with and accept, and for all its faults, it has given all of us a platform, which in the past, look, I mean, if I go back to my origin story in terms of becoming a broadcaster, the fact is that, you know, there were gatekeepers. You had to get past program controllers. You had to send your demo tape out and try and persuade them that you were the person that they should hire and give the overnight slot or whatever it is, give you a start in the business. And there were only those stations. There were the local ones, the national ones, whatever. You had to get a start somewhere. And nowadays, that isn't necessary. My son, 19 years old, is talking about creating his podcast with his mates. The technology is there on his laptops. You just have to do it on Zoom, record it somewhere, bang it out there, create a logo, off you go. It's all democratized. So actually, it's a real positive. But at the same time, one only has to look at the people getting cancelled for saying the wrong thing on social media. Social media is the forum which can make you and break you, as you rightly say, and you've embraced it. And it's interesting, because I think probably out of all our authors within the Hoback family, you are the most active and have embraced it more readily than some. But it's a time suck, isn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. It's like a boat is a money pit. I think social media is a time pit, isn't it? And it's a necessary evil to engage with people. I mean, here's something that made me smile. One of my followers... at me. One of my followers on Twitter has three names. If you're listening, Robert Dawes, Robert of Dawshire, she has three names on her Twitter face bio. And that is Robert Dawes, Russell Crowe, and Lewis Hastings. Those are her three favourite people.
I know who you're talking about.
Yes, I know. I know you know who I'm talking about. And do you know what? It actually, I was rarely speechless that day when I saw that. And I know Russell Crowe has written to me a lot. I've tried to block him a few times. But if you're listening, Mr. Crowe, it's just how it is. You know, you have to watch out. I'm coming after you for popularity's sake. But yeah, I mean, social media, look, we had 2 weeks ago, we ran a giveaway, didn't we, for the Angel of Whitehall?
Yes, we did.
Which, boy, I mean, thanks to Scotland Yard CSI, great people to get into bed with, they or that individual that does so much work to recognise authors around the world, so a huge public thank you there, approached me and said, would you like to do this? I had no idea of the might and power of social media until that weekend. Apparently, we were a bit light as well, compared to some authors, but 42,000 hits, I think it was.
Wow. During
24 hours, you know? I'm basically an author in a huge... If authors were an iceberg, I'm sitting on the sort of the mollusk crustaceans at the bottom at the moment, hoping to get to the slightly bluer ice halfway up. But there you go, 42,000 hits. And they were saying that if we do it again, then we have a game plan that will probably double that. Now, I can't replicate that by putting an advert in the paper, by flying a plane around a specific piece of country or your country or anywhere else for that matter. I say your country, it's still mine. I'm English at heart. But you cannot replicate what social media can do for you. It's viral, isn't it? Literally. So.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's unstoppable. And, you know, it's a reality for us as publishers as well. Lewis, take us through... you talk about it being an addiction, a compulsion to write. Take us through those early stages then when you decided that that's what you wanted to do, because you know, you had this by the point you picked up the keyboard or whatever, you'd been in your role and your job for many, many years, and then it was this big departure. What prompted that?
Well, if we go back, you'll have to do that thing you did last week with the harps playing, going back in time. A huge shout out for my English teacher, who will now sadly have left this mortal coil, because, you know, when you're a youngster, you're sort of at 8 years old, your English teacher is probably, in your opinion, in their 80s. Bless her, she was probably 50 if she was a day, but Theodora Bruton. What a wonderful name, and what a wonderful lady. And I had a slightly fractured childhood, and Theodora Bruton enabled me to, because she knew, good teachers do, don't they? But she knew that by me writing stories, it enabled me to just get some of those demons out. And I do nod to her, definitely, because she gave this love of writing. Now, I do remember having an essay entered into a competition, and the judges said it was the best essay they'd ever seen until the last paragraph, where it became the worst essay they'd ever seen. And that stuck with me for the rest of my adult life. But then what happened in my journey of towards being an author, because I learned quickly there's a difference between a writer and an author. What happened was I decided, having been to a family funeral, learned something about a particular relative that I never knew, that I would write an autobiography. This book became the stuff of urban legend, because people would say, are you still writing the autobiography, Lewis? And I say, yes, you know. And this went on for nearly 7 years. And in that 7 years, I'd written 11 chapters. Worse than your writing speed at the moment, Adrian. But yeah, it says,
certainly.
taking tongue out of cheek. What happened was I did an international piece of work that brought me back to the motherland. And during that, I guess that time back in the country, I learned that my dear old dad had terminal cancer. And he said to me, look, I've got a year at best. So I left him, got to Heathrow, got on the plane and went back through Thailand and thought, I've got to finish this autobiography. So in 5 months, I wrote another 44 chapters and self-published it. The following year, I flew back, and I hope this tugs at the heartstrings of your listeners, because trust me, it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. I sat at his bedside in a hospice and I read it to him. And it was one of the most, you talk about cathartic experiences, it was one of the most moving, life-changing things I've ever done. Now, you may wonder what this has got to do with Jack Cade and everything else. Well, in the middle of that time that I was with him, he said to me, that piece there in the autobiography, I'd like you, please, to go away and create a novel from it. I think you've got something, and I think people would want to listen to what you've got to say. So I got back on that plane, and again, I flew back through Hong Kong that time. And when I hit the ground, I started Seventh. And I wrote Seventh in very quick time. Big book, as you know, aren't they all? And decided that the only way I could get it out there to at least print 4 copies was self-publish on Amazon. So I did that. I printed 4 copies and sent one back. Sadly, he never got to see it. We lost him just before he got to see that book. The others were for my wife and my 2 kids. So they have a copy of that, an original one. And at that point, I kind of felt that, for me, the author in me would always be a shrinking violet, you know? And then the bug started, and then it became really, really infectious. And I knocked out 7 Degrees in 9 months, and then followed up with 7 of Swords in a year, during a really, really time in the UK with Brexit and everything else that was occurring. And 7 of Swords just hit the ground running and really, for me, cemented the trilogy. And then, of course, you have that moment of loss. Finish the trilogy, so what do you do next? And you know what comes next. The Angel of Whitehall. Yeah, now the Angel of Whitehall is, I can go back to the trilogy, but the Angel of Whitehall was a standalone. So the trilogy, which with hindsight could have been 6 books. But Peter James had said to me, mate, if your story is big enough, don't worry about the size of the book. If it's overinflated just for the hell of it, then yeah, we'll lose any credibility. But if the story is big enough, then just back yourself. That's what I did. The Angel of Whitehall is a standalone. And the real angel is yet again someone extremely dear to my heart, who we lost during COVID late last year. And again, when we published The Angel, we were 3 days too late, which was a real shame, to say the least. But I think he knows. I have a feeling he knows. And so the real angel was a man who at 17 was fighting against the Japanese Navy in Guadalcanal, the Solomon Islands, and north of Australia, up into the Marshalls and places like that, at 17. And he had a real story to tell, and he talked fondly about it, unlike a lot of people that came back from the war. He often talked fondly about his time in the Navy. And it's sowed a seed for the Angel of Whitehall, which I really enjoyed writing. That's probably the quickest book I've ever written, apart from The Chemist.
Well, we love The Angel of Whitehall, and we love all your books, but it was one of those books which, when I first read it, you know, I was just transported. And yeah, I mean, it's so moving in many, 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 many areas. But we'll talk about that in a minute. Let's bring it up to date then. So you self-published those books, and then there's a communication. We'll bring in Rebecca at this point, this very famous moment. Go on, Rebecca.
Well, we were talking earlier about social media and the sort of democratization of sort of creative industries, and that's how we came across each other, isn't it? Through Twitter.
Absolutely. I only really to have my backside kicked and got onto that platform not long before then. So little did I know where I was talking to. It was extremely exotic.
Tesco's car park.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know. Waitrose, probably a little bit more upmarket, Marks and Spencer's.
I know, I should have told you it was Waitrose, shouldn't I? But no, I mean, from my perspective, from what I remember is, I think you commented on something on our Twitter feed about being a writer. And then I think we sort of, we exchanged a couple of messages, and I looked up on your website and I thought, ooh, he looks interesting.
And you came rushing back. This is where I pick up the story in terms of, you know, you went, I think I found someone. Look at his website and look at, you know, and so that was how it started. And then we started negotiating, and it's...
Well, we asked you to send a submission, didn't we?
Yeah, and that's right.
And this is the part of the story that I've told many people. So it was a Saturday morning, and I quite like reading submissions in the bath, because the test for me is if the water goes cold, it's a good one. If I leap out the bath while the water's still hot and throw it to cast it aside, then it's not for us. And yours turned the water cold. So it passed that test.
I should have that tattooed on my shoulder, really, shouldn't I? I turned Rebecca's water cold. in Latin, obviously.
Oh, yes. And it could actually mean something completely different.
It's like what actors say, isn't it? That, you know they've got a good script, so they read it on the bog. The toilet. And the seat goes cold. It gives me an opportunity to do the Michael Caine accent.
That. Not Michael Caine. Oh, dear. Here we go.
I got the script for 60...
Oh, my God, there's two of them.
I got the script for Mona Lisa, and I just knew that I had to do it. It's true, it's what he said.
I knew that The Angel of Whitehall was obviously going to be a success.
Well, I don't think I could do a Michael Caine well.
Sadly,
I sound like a Dalek.
I'm too old to play Jack Cade. It's unfortunate, but I might be able to play.
I could be the real Carrie.
I could be Tom. What you think that Michael Caine could be Carrie?
No.
I tell you what, Michael Caine, if Sir Michael Caine is listening and he wants to play Tom, he is exactly the right person. You need to have a bit of a beard, but hey, why not?
Yeah, he'd just grow his educating Rita beard back, and then he'd be right away, wouldn't he?
If you're listening, Michael, you can contact us through the Hobeck website, or you can email us at hobeckbooks@gmail.com.
Or we'll see you down the club, as we often do,
Michael. So Tesco's car park. That, you know, when I put two little words into my submission, separated by a colon, and you replied back with them in there, and I knew that you'd read it, and I knew that it had got you. And I, because without being arrogant, unlike a certain wizard writer, I'd only approached five publishers and one agent at that point over the course of the preceding year. And I got a few of the standard replies back. Actually, a little side story, if I can. I have a relative who in 1962 wrote a detective story set in Malta, and I have that manuscript. I may type it up one day as her legacy, but on top of that manuscript is a letter from a publisher that turned me down, and between 1963 and 2018, guess what, the letter was exactly the same.
No.
Yeah, exactly the same. And I thought, well, you've clearly moved on. Whereas yours had, there was just passion. There was a sense of urgency, a sense of, I don't know, just like I said the other day in a tweet about you guys, I think you're wonderful. There's a sense of transparency and honesty about you that settled my nerves very quickly. You know, you didn't hide the fact that you're new, but you didn't hide the fact either that your indie-spirited trad values go an awful long way. And yeah, a great author friend of mine, Patricia Kaliskan, she said to me a while ago, you haven't found your publisher yet. And it didn't mean it. I didn't understand it at the time. That you will understand when it happens. And when we did, and when you wrote back and said, I think the words something Adrian were along the lines of, we're supposed to leave you dangling, but we're going to go for it. We'd like to work with you. Something along those lines.
Yes, I remember. Yes.
Yeah. And I marked the email as unread, went to work, came home, read it again, marked it as unread, went to bed. And then the next morning I said to Mrs. Hastings, have a read of this. And she said, well, have you replied yet? No, not yet. And she said, well, I think you should. Why are you holding back? And I've heard a few of your authors talk about this, and I've heard other authors talk on podcasts. We are probably the worst enemy of ourselves in that we know what we've done is creatively good enough to entertain people, but we have this inherent fear that it's going to be rejected. Mm. But you didn't. And when I got that email, which is printed off and framed on very expensive parchment, it was a life changer for me. I knew I wasn't going to become W.H. Smith's number one bestseller in the first year. Mm-hmm. I think in year two, we will probably get into the top 10, he says, unplanted firmly and left cheeky again. But you don't know. This is the reality of the market and the world that we're involved in now. Just like we're seeing this hideous virus in real life, book sales can become viral. I think, look at The Chain, you know, the novel The Chain. Completely viral very, very quickly.
Because it won the prize, wasn't it?
Yeah, and there's an element of that. I think there's an element of timing. There's an element of luck. And there's just, yeah, it's just having a product that you all believe in.
Yes.
But the bottom line is, would I like to be successful with a terrible story or unsuccessful with a great one? Don't know the answer to that.
Nor do we, actually. But look, you're right. I mean, it was one of those things where we put aside the usual caveats and reticence and whatever. I mean, it is always, I mean, from the perspective of a publisher, when you're looking at an author who you're considering, and I suppose that now we're down the journey of signing, you know, almost a dozen authors now, and more submissions coming in, it is actually harder to because you know that when you take someone on, you're building it's a new member of the family. And it's a new relationship, and it's the communication is something you need to learn. What does what makes each author tick? What they have to understand how we work and adapt, and you know, we're adapting around an author's personality, or a lot of it's around fear and anticipating what is motivating them to question what we're doing. And actually, you know, publishing, I think, is in many ways a suspension of fear. It is that taking the plunge and putting yourself out there as a writer or indeed as a publisher. It requires tremendous courage and strength of character. I think it's underestimated just how much that is. People put it down to, of course you're going to want to put book published because you've got an ego and la, la, la. It's not like that at all, because you're opening yourself up in the way you write and the way you people respond to your writing. You're opening yourself up hugely, and you're very vulnerable. And I think we feel the same as publishers. You know, every book we publish could be the one that makes us or breaks us. We just don't know.
I think you're absolutely, you've hit the poor old nail on the head. I'm sure that now we'll get sick of that. But the reality is that I have yet, correct me if I'm wrong, I've yet to come across an author with an ego.
Mm.
And yet you do, I'm sorry to say it, you see people from screen and that sort of side of things. Sorry, Bob. Not that you've got an ego, my friend, because you've been great to me as well. But authors, I don't know, they're almost very, almost Dickensian humble, aren't we? Sometimes, you know, it just, I don't know what it is. And I think for me, when you consider what I do for a day job, if I want to be famous, there's no better way than being an author, because I can still walk down the street and go to Tesco's, go to Waitrose, Asda, or wherever, you know, and no one will really know who I am. And I think that's part of the appeal.
Lewis Hastings joining us from New Zealand, and we will feature part two of that interview next week on the Hobcast. And the week after that, we've got a very special program, because we're speaking to a panel of bloggers, the people who really drive this industry forward and kindly support us as publishers and authors by reviewing our books and giving them publicity. And, you know, that's no small task, because, you know, there's a lot of reading involved and a lot of work in social media. But we'll talk to our panel of bloggers in a couple of weeks' time after our second part of that Lewis Hastings interview, which really enjoyable interview. In fact, you know, we just neither party could stop talking.
I think, you know, we actually sat here recording for 2 hours, and for us it was straight after breakfast, but for Lewis it was before bed.
Yeah,
so I hope he got enough sleep last night.
Yeah, he crept into bed at about midnight, just after midnight. So you know, thank you so much for spending time with us. Now then, let's talk about two very serious issues. The first of which is simply awful, really. We lost two members of the Hoback family this week. And before we go any further, we ought to mention that these are two feline members of the Hoback family, but they're no less important for that, because let's be honest, a pet is a member of a family, and a pet also gives you, well, when you're a creative type, immense distraction when you need it, support when you need it, unconditionally. And they refill the creative well. I think that's fair, isn't it?
They do. And they also keep you company when you're sat there creating or working, and your four-legged friend comes up for a bit of a fuss. You know, you might say, oh, go away, I'm busy. But actually,
yeah,
you know, appreciate the sort of the inputs that they can give. And
yeah, they're brilliant. So obviously we have Aki here, who is the Hoback cat, but there were two other members of the family who passed on this week. So let's pay tribute to them. Bonkers, who is Karina Swans, one of her pair of cats, been with her for 15 years, very important member of the family, and obviously had witnessed Karina's own battles with illness in recent years.
And we actually had the pleasure to meet Bonkers just the once. So
wonderful, gentle soul. Very, very friendly cat.
He actually sat between us, didn't he, on the sofa?
That's right, when we were negotiating, you know, how we were going to take forward Blood Loss, which we published, you know, a week ago or so, and, you know, work with Kerry. And as she said in an email to me this week, you know, he was a very important part of the Care Forum family. That's the business that she runs with her husband, which provides staff to support families with people with you know, caring needs. And Bonkers was part of that family too. So very, very sad to hear of Bonkers passing at the age of 15, a good age for a cat, but nonetheless, no less sad for that. And the other member, I mean, I think you've met the other cat that we're talking about.
So Kerry has two cats, but also Jane Mapp, who has designed quite a few of our book covers, she also had two cats. And so sadly, one of her cats passed away on the same day as Bonkers did. And this is the lovely Rosie, also known as Lulu. So it was a sad day for all of us, which the irony was it was the same day that Blood Loss was published.
Yeah, with a cover by Jane.
So, with a cover by Jane, yeah.
Book by Carina, cover by Jane, and both, you know, unable, clearly, you know, with other things on their minds on a day that normally is a day for celebration and you know, and hope. But, you know, okay, but you know, people might accuse us of overdoing this, but I do think that, you know, you cannot underplay the importance of people's pets in a creative environment.
I mean, you think about our
cat. Or any environment.
Our cat, she's not here right now, unusually, but she did appear at the beginning of the interview with Lewis Hastings. I just cannot imagine our business without Aki's input. It just wouldn't be the same.
No, it wouldn't. With her mounting your keyboard on a regular basis, or, you know, using the corner of a laptop for a scratching post, or
she does that a lot,
or interrupting my audio editing, demanding food, or all sorts of things, or, in as we've heard on the Hopcast many, many times, invading the studio space and making her feelings felt on whatever subject we're talking about. So
she actually helps us choose submissions between the submissions we want to take up and we don't.
Yeah,
if sometimes. She sits on top of it, then that's a good one.
She does. Well, sadly, you know, we'd like to thank Bonkers and Rosie for their contribution to, you know, people in our lives. We do treat Hoback as a family. So that's all the authors and all the contributors and the people who, you know, design covers for us. And anyone has input in our products, you know, they're part of our family. It's as simple as that. And we feel that's a really important part of the ethos.
As long as I'm not the mother.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, we've got Uncle Bob.
We do. Yes.
Robert Dawes. Now, the other concerning factor this week, and I'm sorry to finish on a downer, but I have a confession to make. But we are running a competition. You may have noticed it on social media or indeed on our emails. If you have subscribed to us at www.hobeck.net, we are running a competition involving cream eggs, Cadbury's cream eggs, tied in with Wendy Turbin's Sleeping Dogs. Now, her main character, private investigator Penny Wiseman, is a fan of cream eggs. So we thought we would do a competition accordingly.
And she's not the only fan of Cadbury's cream eggs, it turns out.
No. Okay. Now, what the prize involves is one gigantic cream egg, a cookbook involving cream eggs with some Hoback blend coffee beans, which are an exclusive blend from a local supplier that we have, a good friend of ours, David. Also, some Hoback mug and 48 of your standard cream eggs.
At least it started off as 48 of your standard cream eggs.
Yeah, you did an audit this week, didn't you?
Yes.
And you found that there was one missing.
Well, I've done two audits. I found out there was one missing and I immediately, and I apologise profusely if you're listening, my middle son, I immediately assumed it was him because he has a bit of a sweet tooth. But no, I don't think it was him. And then I did another audit and found there were 46 cream eggs.
Yeah. And what else happened after that then?
Well, you very kindly turned your pockets out for me last night.
And you found?
I found a wrapper.
A crumpled...
The evidence is clear. A crumpled cream egg wrapper.
Yeah, okay. It was me.
He did admit it, to be fair. He did fess
both.
Up.
I ate both. I had a weak moment of weakness at about 11 o'clock on Wednesday night. And I also had a moment of weakness during Formula One qualifying
and
Saturday afternoon.
Formula One is on again today, the day we record this. So I wouldn't be surprised if another one goes missing. However, he has promised to the competition winner that he will replenish the cream eggs up to 48. But not only that, he's going to round it up to 50, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I am, which gives me the opportunity to buy, to eat one more and then get a 5-pack, which are on offer at Co-op. So there we go. That's been a controversial part of what has otherwise been a roller coaster week for us. Busy, busy, busy. Lots of things going on. We've done all sorts of things on social media, even making videos. To mark 3 weeks away from publishing Malcolm Holland Drake's Merseyside crime series with the first book, Catch As Catch Can. They look great.
And not only that, yesterday I had the pleasure of reading the first chapter of Rock to Death, the forthcoming next instalment in the Rock crime series by our lovely Uncle Bob, Robert Dawes.
Yeah. So that's an exclusive preview for a book that we're planning to bring out in a few months' time. So we're getting close to getting that manuscript through, as indeed, as you heard, we'll get The Chemist soon from Lewis Hastings.
We're going to be really busy reading, aren't we?
Boy, are we busy. And I've been writing, before we forget.
How many words?
Well, a good deal more than normal. So into four figures, but around the 1600 mark.
That is actually very good. I'm very impressed. I hadn't quite realised it was that many. I think he's been writing while I've been asleep.
Yeah, I've done three stabs at writing and I've made real progress with the book. And I'm really thrilled with getting the flow back a little bit. But I know that, you know, that should be the average for every day rather than a week, but nonetheless, it's all progress.
And he's read some of it out loud to me, which is, it's something that we do, that sometimes when he writes some new material, he says, would you like to hear it? And I go, yeah. And so I think you're in for a treat. When this book finally comes out, you're in for a treat.
Yes, you are. You are. Except I have been deflected by my new passion, which is the Shakespearean author debate, which I stumbled into last week watching a clip with Derek Jacobi, who strongly believes that William Shakespeare of Stratford did not write the plays. And now I've just gone down this rabbit hole of finding out more evidence to suggest one way or the other. Was it William Shakespeare that we recognise in Stratford as the author of the plays? Or was it someone else like the Earl of Oxford? I just need to know. And it's an obsession.
And this book you're writing now, was it written by Adrian Hobart or was it written by someone else?
Right. Unlikely to be written by me, the speed at which I'm doing it.
No, but it has been your obsession this week, hasn't it?
Yeah, and unfortunately my dialogue in my 1940s setting has suddenly become forsooth and thou art a vagrant and such and such, which probably isn't in keeping with the period.
And he's been talking to me like that as well.
Yeah, well, at least I haven't slipped into, you know, full line of duty mode.
That is my obsession at the moment, I should add. So until last Sunday, I had not seen Line of Duty, and I'd seen lots of things about it on social media and thought, oh, I should watch this thing. Everybody loves it. So we decided to start from scratch at the beginning so I could catch up and then hopefully get to current season. Is it season six?
Yeah, current season six, but we're just starting season three.
But we've done quite well in a week. It's a week exactly. And I'm sucked in completely. I love it. It's brilliant.
It is brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. And all power to Jeb Mercurio, who I don't think has written anything duff in his entire career. If you haven't seen Bodies, it's superb from a few years ago. And obviously Bodyguard was a big hit last year. So it's enough about Jeb Mercurio. I don't think we're necessarily going to sign him as a Hoback author, but boy, is he great to draw inspiration from. So before anyone else reveals what happens in Series 6 of Line of Duty, we'll wrap it up there for the Hopcast. Don't forget to go to our website, www.hobeck.net, for all sorts of details there. Not least, sign up to our mailing list and you get access to a whole plethora of novellas and free stories from our wonderful Hobeck authors. But from me, Adrian Hobart.
And me, Rebecca Collins.
It remains for us to wish you a great week ahead. Thank you for listening to the Hopcast. And have a great, creative, and safe week.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.